This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Hi, I'm Peter Terzakian, and welcome to another one of our ARC Energy Ideas Podcasts. It is February 22nd, 2019.
And I'm Jackie Forrest, and today I'm excited to introduce our special guest, Susanna Pierce, Director of External Relations for LNG Canada. I'm sure many of our listeners know this will be Canada's first major LNG export facility on our West Coast, sending out 1.8 BCF per day before 2025. So welcome, Susanna.
Yeah, welcome, Susanna.
Thank you. Excited to be here with both of you.
Good. So I wanted to start with the big picture, talk a little bit about the global LNG picture, and then where Canada's position fits within that, and then definitely talk about the specifics of LNG Canada's mega project that you sanctioned in the fall of 2018. But before I get going, I want to recognize an award that Susanna just got in February from the Vancouver Business Group. She was awarded the Influential Women in Business Award. So congrats on that.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. I think it goes to show that this project is significant in a number of different ways. And so, yeah, pleased to be a part of that.
Yeah. Actually, can I just sort of put the significance in context? It's 1.8 BCF, billion cubic feet per day of natural gas, as Jackie mentioned. So, Jackie, let's put that into how much we produce in Western Canada. What are we at, 16 billion cubic feet?
That's right.
So another 2 of takeaway capacity is really meaningful.
Right. And as we'll talk, Susanna, right, there's the potential for it to grow.
Yeah, that's right. So we've designed the project to be built in phases because, as you can imagine, for a project investment of this scale, you want to show that you can actually deliver the first phase effectively before you take on the next chunk. And so the first phase of the project is essentially 2 trains at about 7 million tons per annum per train, and that equivalent is to what you said earlier, about 1.8 BCF a day. So in the context of current production, yeah, it's a great start.
I mean, it's a 25% boost if in both phases to the current production levels.
Yeah, and given that so much of the natural gas is effectively bottled up in Western Canada, it'll be really welcomed.
All right, let's talk about the global picture, you know, in terms of the outlook for the need for LNG. And I wanted to reference an annual report that Shell issues called the LNG Outlook. There was one issued in 2018, and I think a new one's coming. Is that right, Susanna?
Yeah, as soon as next week. And so this is something that Shell started doing a couple of years ago. And it was really in order to help Shell understand where the LNG markets are going, looking at both supply and demand, as well as what does it take to be competitive. And so I think these reports are fantastic. They're very well received. And yeah, I'm looking forward to reading the next one that'll be issued next week.
Yeah, it's on my reading list as well. But we'll talk about last year's results, and I'm sure the direction of travel hasn't changed too much. At that time, Shell expected that growth in LNG would increase by between 1.5 and 2 times by 2035 versus today. So what is underpinning that very strong growth forecast? That's really, in the hydrocarbon world, that's the strongest growth forecast that's out there.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to look at just where we were a couple of years ago when a lot of people believed that there would be an LNG supply glut. Well, that turned out to not be the case. And the reason for that largely is because you've seen a substantial increase in demand as you look at a number of different regions and countries that are looking to decarbonize. And so how do we get off some of the more carbon-intensive forms of energy like coal? And so China's been leading that growth, as has Korea. So Korea also has a number of coal facilities they're looking to displace with natural gas. And the other piece of this is not only just decarbonization, but it's air quality. Because if you go to, as I'm sure you all have, and I know, Peter, you have, to places like Beijing or other parts of South Korea, you see that air quality is pretty poor. Mm-hmm. And even India, I think you're beginning to see a lot of effort put into looking for natural gas to help clear air as well as to decarbonize. And so when you see the government push, the regulatory push for these efforts, you begin to see that the demand for natural gas has really increased. Now, how do you get that natural gas to these markets? Well, you can get it a number of different ways. If you have domestic production, you can go there. If you have pipelines to other places with domestic production, you can go there. But what we're also seeing is in cases where you may not have sufficient domestic production or you don't want to have to rely on just pipelines, so you're looking at supply security, you want supply diversity, and that's where LNG comes in as well. And so from our perspective, it's a very robust growth market, and as the last year's report showed, we're expecting about 4% compound annual growth rate per year going forward, which really begins to see a great new market opening up going forward.
Yeah, I mean, 4% growth, that's on the LNG itself. And just for context for our audience, like we're talking about liquefied natural gas, which is gas that is taken and compressed about 600 times and cooled and put into liquid form. and then it's put on specialized tankers and then is able to go to all sorts of destinations around the world.
Yeah, and it's actually just a point on the LNG. So really what you do is you just chill it like you would put it into a refrigerator, a bunch of cryogenic tubes, and refrigerate it, and it goes to minus 162 degrees Celsius. And so it's really not compressed. It's just in its liquid form, it's able to be put onto carriers mm-hmm. in a fashion that allows you to transport it very efficiently.
Right.
All right. So this, you touched on the fact that there was this view that we would have a glut for some time, but because of the demand in China and India and other places, we're finding that we're going to need some more projects. And so the report talked about the fact that the existing projects under construction were only enough to meet demand until the mid-2020s. So there's a need actually almost now to start sanctioning new projects because it takes 4 or 5 years for those projects to come online. And basically the outlook was forecasting another 23 to 36 BCF per day of supply needed between now and 2035. So lots of potential for projects to be sanctioned. So the big question is Canada going to become a larger supplier of that future wedge? I mean, the good news is we know that LNG Canada at least will be part of that supply, and we hope there'll be other projects that follow that as well.
Yeah, this is a great project just to get started, and if we can ensure that we have other projects moving forward to help meet that demand, we absolutely should.
So let's just talk quickly about your project. We already talked about the size and capacity, but about the partners on the project.
Yeah. So we are a project that has the great benefit of having really the best partners in the world as it relates to LNG development. So as you're aware, Shell is a 40% participating interest in the project, followed by Petronas at 25%, followed by PetroChina at 15%, Mitsubishi Corporation at 15%, and Korea Gas. And so when you consider who you want to have in a joint venture, I don't think you can think of a better development of partners, because when you really consider that they have both the upstream, the midstream, as well as the marketing expertise, you've got end-to-end. And I think that's really set us forward as the dream team, as I've called us in the past.
Well, and the interesting thing is, you know, a big barrier for these projects is getting the customers to all sign up, and some of your partners also need gas domestically as well.
Yeah, and so that's a nice part of this, is where you can actually find that some of your investors are actually the marketers and the consumers, and so it actually allows you to have much more effective supply chain.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the gas pipeline. I think is a unique part of Canadian projects. You know, some areas of the world, the gas is more close to the LNG facilities, but in Canada, one of our challenges is that we've got fairly long distance to connect the gas production with the LNG terminal on the coast. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, the length and the challenge in terms of connecting the supply with the project?
Yeah, sure. So I think the project, as many of may be aware, is a partnership with Coastal GasLink, which is a company of TransCanada Pipelines. And so Coastal GasLink is responsible for both the permitting, construction, and operations of the pipeline. It's a 670-kilometer pipeline, essentially going from the Montney Basin around Dawson Creek all the way through to Kitimat. It'll cross essentially two mountain ranges. So from a technical perspective, pretty spectacular, going across the Rockies and the coastal mountains into Kitimat. And we've spoken to this quite frequently because I think it's an important part of this project. It actually goes through 20 individual First Nations traditional territories. And that's significant from the perspective that Coastal GasLink really has done a very good job of sitting down and working with each of those nations, both elected and hereditary chiefs, in order to arrive at agreements with each of them that will see them participate in the project, not only just be a landholder, but also be a part of the project as it relates to construction activities and operation activities and things like that. So that's significant.
Mm-hmm. But recently there have been some holdouts, like with the Wet'suwet'en and Unist'ot'en mm-hmm. areas.
Yeah.
How's that playing
out? Yeah, and on that, it's something where, again, folks who've been following pipelines in BC will recall that this is actually a group that's been around for a while. The Unist'ot'en came up originally opposed to the Northern Gateway pipeline. Now, obviously, Coastal GasLink being a gas pipeline, natural gas is a little bit different as it relates to, I think, public acceptance. But in this particular area of the Wet'suwet'en First Nations, of which there are five, there's also a number of hereditary chiefs, and they're actually a part of something called the Office of the Wet'suwet'en. Essentially, there are 13 of them, and there are approximately five that are not supportive of the project, and those voices have been heard recently with respect to some protests and blockades. You know, I'm confident, though, that the broader collective benefits of this project across all of those other nations and the thousands of members within those nations will, I think, come to bear. And I think they'll, at the end of the day, be a positive outcome as it relates to being able to move forward with that pipeline through the Wet'suwet'en and working with the hereditary chiefs. So while nobody likes to see any kind of opposition, you also recognize you could never get 100% support. So I think there's a path forward there, and that'll be helpful as we move the project ahead.
Yeah, and we had talked about this on a prior podcast on, you know, how there seems to be this a lot of attention to the people that aren't supportive, but maybe not as much media attention to the people that are supportive. And I have been following the great work LNG Canada has been doing with social media, and you've put a lot of information out with videos of various groups, and, you know, including the elected chief of the Haisla First Nation, and Blueberry First Nation has a thing about how they're supporting the project. So, you know, I really encourage people to look at on Twitter at your feed to kind of start to hear other voices and their perspectives on the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk about the timing? So the project was given the green light last year. And so when can we expect the first cargoes to be leaving?
Well, the timing is really to geared towards that that new demand for the LNG. So it's going to be in the mid-2020s. And I think it's something which obviously we're in construction today. And so we're actively targeting, you know, to be ahead of that so that we're ready to go when that new supply and demand gap opens up.
Mid-20s, in other words, 2024-ish. Is that a safe?
Yeah, that's the time frame we're looking at, into mid-20s.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the costs. We've been hearing the number $40 billion, which is just huge in terms of the investment that is going in. So what does that include?
Yeah, so the cost really comprises everything from the upstream, the pipeline, the plant, and the shipping. And so when you really consider the full value chain, that's what the overall number represents.
So that includes the drilling?
Yeah, it includes a small increment into the drilling to make sure that you have enough sufficient capacity or production for the plant. And then the numbers that we've really been quite public about include the numbers with respect to the EPC contract that we have with JGC Fluor, as well as the pipeline. But then the other pieces are really just the ongoing investment related to this project in the upstream, as well as some shipping costs.
So it doesn't include like all the upstream investment over 20 or 40 years. It's just the sort of initial upstream investment.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And in fact, you know, and we've talked about this in the past, I think it's a substantial opportunity for the upstream just on phase one and phase two, should there be a phase two going forward, because, you know, in order to keep production constant, you have to continue to drill. So I think there's great upside there as well.
Yeah, I think the economic benefits of LNG are big. First of all, to put that $40 billion in perspective, over a decade, $200 billion was spent in the oil sands. And so, you know, one of these major projects, you know, is a quarter of the type of investment we saw over that decade where we saw so much investment in the oil sands. So this is really significant. But I think it's an underestimate of the real benefits, because if you think about the upstream over, you know, this plant is 40 years or so, you're expecting to be producing LNG. Is that right? Yeah, so 40 years of upstream investment. And then I was also thinking, you know, the other big part of this is because of all this gas production that we wouldn't have had otherwise, there's probably going to be liquids like NGLs, ethane, propane. And as we can see in Alberta lately, there is the opportunity to value add and to make other products. So there's also that potential for the petrochemical business that wouldn't have been there if we didn't have this production.
Yeah, I think it's just the beginning of something that could be quite fantastic for the province and, you know, Western Canada, quite frankly, when you really think about it. So, yeah, and that's, I know that there are a number of different companies that are looking at opportunities like that. So it's quite exciting.
Yeah, it really is exciting. And it's also exciting from the perspective of taking advantage of our competitive position geographically. Can you talk about the Gulf Coast of the United States, which is also ramping up their LNG exports, versus the West Coast of BC and Kitimat, where your facility is going to be located?
Yeah, so there's it's a good comparison, because when you're really looking at taking a final investment decision, you want to understand how you rank with other areas you may choose to invest. And so for LNG Canada in the Canadian context, we do have an advantage, which is the shorter shipping distance to the North Asian LNG market. And so for us, approximately 8 to 10 days to do that. If you're in the U.S. Gulf Coast, you can be as much as 24 days shipping to that same market. So the shipping is a significant advantage. The other advantage we have, as many of your listeners may be aware, is the low cost of the upstream gas. And so comparatively to Henry Hub pricing market, we have an advantage there, which really sets us ahead. Now, as you mentioned earlier, I think one of the disadvantages we have is really just the level of capital investment that is required, because we haven't had the pipeline networks that you do in the U.S. Gulf Coast, nor have we really had essentially the LNG facilities. In the past, the United States had a number of LNG import facilities, and so what they've been able to do is essentially flip the switch, it's a simple way of saying it, which is to really reinvest in some of these same facilities to make them export facilities. So from an overall capital investment perspective, you know, they have an advantage there as a result of that. But I think in what we've been able to do in terms of really looking at how do we drive costs down, how do we take advantage of the advantages, how do we work with other stakeholders, including government, I might add, both the federal and provincial government, in order to get to a place of competitiveness. You know, we've really been able to demonstrate that we can be competitive and we can be one of those suppliers that can fit into the portfolio to serve future demand. And that's, you know, that's something that we spent quite a bit of time working to do. And again, it's not just ourselves, it's working with partners, working with governments in order to get there. And, you know, as a result of that, we had the FID last year.
Yeah, and that was such exciting news. And one thing that came out of your FID is Royal Dutch Shell actually put out some slides that day that talked about the economics of your project compared to the Gulf Coast. And they showed that your project was cheaper in their view, in terms of you could deliver gas for a lower price to Asia than the U.S. could. So they had a number around $7 per MMBT, that's U.S. dollars, and the U.S. delivering around $7.50 U.S. dollars per MMBTU. To put it in context, the current spot price in Japan is about $8. So this is great. It can deliver gas below the going price. And I had been for a long time a champion for LNG Canada and LNG in Canada in general, and saying, you know, I think we can beat the U.S., but a lot of these analysts that are out there, whether it be WoodMac or IHS, you know, they always showed the Canadian cost is quite high. And it was great to see some validation that we can do it. We have a competitive advantage. And hopefully that will be, you know, a catalyst for other people to really seriously look at Canada.
Yeah, and it is about building confidence. It's about building confidence that, yes, we can. And it's obviously going to be critical to build confidence through the execution and the construction of the facility. So we've set our targets. We know what we need to do. And now we just got to go ahead and get it done. And getting it done is really living up to our commitments to build this project on schedule, at cost, and so that we can be a part of that great portfolio of new options. And it's exciting, and it's, you know, it's an everyday, it's very hard work to get to the FID. And the analogy that one of our Shell executive vice presidents used was getting to a final FID or final investment decision is like a moon landing. Building it is like bringing your people back. And I think that's a very relevant analogy when you consider, all right, hard work to get it to a final investment decision, but wow, hard work to actually get it done. And that's the phase that we're in. And we've got some great partners, continue to be great partners, both with who our EPC is, as well as the governments. And, you know, and the local supporters, Jackie, that you mentioned earlier, from First Nations to communities, to the north of BC, and increasingly what I'm seeing, also the southern part of BC, Lower Mainland, and clearly Western Canada and Alberta, where we recognize how important it is to be able to get our natural gas to new markets that really are growing the fastest and really need our nice Canadian diverse supply.
And I want to bring up one more point before we leave this topic for our listeners that may not be aware of this, but, you know, the U.S. has really been growing in terms of their LNG. When we look at the projects that are in operation, under construction, or sanctioned, they're close to 12 BCF per day of capacity. And we're talking about 1.8 BCF per day with your first phase. So there's such a prize here for Canada. And at this point, we're losing. If it was a race between Canadian LNG and U.S. LNG, we're behind. From your perspective, Susanna, why do you think that we've seen the U.S. have so many more sanctions and projects moving forward?
You know, there's a number of different reasons, I think, one of which, as I mentioned earlier, is you've got a country that's used to LNG because of the import facilities they previously had. So, again, there's a familiarity with it, both in terms of how people know what it is, but also regulators know what it is. You know, and we're trying to build a facility in British Columbia. We actually had to have LNG regs written some years ago. And so I think, number one, there's a familiarity with LNG. The other one, which I think for all of us in Canada is just the focus, and it's certainly that we've seen with this current president of the United States on becoming an energy superpower, a dedication, a recognition of the importance of that. And so there's been, you know, a singular focus on what do we do to get our resources not only domestically to market, but internationally to market. Mm-hmm. And I think that has really generated the focus and the commitment to get it done. And so therefore, you see that there's just that element, which I think has really helped the United States step forward. And I think from the Canadian perspective, too, as a proud Canadian that I am, we have to continue to consider how we are competitive, because competing against ourselves doesn't do us any favors. We need to continue to look around the rest of the world at what they're doing well and what we can do well, if not better, so that we can, you know, get ahead of them. And so in Canada, what I think we have to do is continue to have that singular focus and commitment that we see in the United States has had on how they try and do so.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think, but it goes beyond competitiveness. It's also just as Canadians taking sovereignty over our supply chains and being able to directly export our natural gas to other markets other than the United States, which has been our paradigm for decades. But, you know, having said that, I think we have to tackle sort of the domestic controversies and the domestic, I'll call it almost conflicts with the narratives about meeting our Paris agreements and, you know, particularly in BC, the sensitivities to the greenhouse gas emission issue and continuing to build out fossil fuel supply chains and so on. How do you think about that, or how do you speak to those sorts of concerns?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Peter, because I think Canada, and I said this almost at the year we had our wonderful 150th birthday, we're in a bit of an existential crisis as to who do we think we are and who do we want to be. And I firmly believe that we are a country with prolific natural resources that produced well, sustainably, with regulations and with support, should be reaching global markets, because we do it well. And we have some of the best regulations in place, the best environmental standards, robust resources where the world needs them. I think we have to, number one, recognize that. And then number two, also recognize how well it is we're doing what we're doing as it relates to some of those things that you mentioned, including carbon intensity, carbon commitments, things like that. When you consider the LNG Canada project, one of the initial decisions we made right out of the gate is to recognize that in this global energy transition where the world is looking to see how we can get to lower carbon content energy supplies, lower carbon content anything, frankly, how do we actually design our projects so that we're keeping that in mind? Keeping that in mind while we're also trying to be competitive. And so one of the things that we did is we looked at how we could decrease the carbon intensity right out of the gate. Now, when you make these decisions earlier on in the context of where we think the world is going, it allows you not have to go back later. One, recognizing we're a resource country. Two, planning our projects in mind of where do we think society is going, where is the world going, is some of these major issues which we're facing, and designing our projects with that in mind. I think we'll find that we can actually do both, be a resource-rich country as well as do our best to meet commitments, some of which will be global commitments like Paris. And, you know, as far as Paris commitment and how do we find ourselves meeting, you know, our own commitments to keep the world temperature less than 2 degrees Celsius, again, I think Canada has great opportunity to do that. Look at the power intensity of our overall grid. I mean, we have a substantial amount of hydropower, particularly in BC, where the extent to which it's available, it's cost effective. You know, there's opportunities to be working with that. But it does take all of us kind of working together to find those solutions. Sure. And this is something where increasingly in BC, people are realizing that if I have significant resource investment or investment in resources, that's the revenues that I need in order to pay for the schools and the hospitals and the upgrades to infrastructure, and even some of those decarbonization projects, which we also want to pursue. So I think there's a great partnership ahead if we keep our mindsets in the right place.
Right. We could be part of the solution. So let's talk about that greenhouse gas emissions intensity, because I'm not sure if that's well understood by everyone in Canada. But your project, how does it compare in terms of the carbon emissions per unit of LNG that goes out compared to a project on the Gulf Coast, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question. So again, as a result of using some of the renewable power from BC Hydro, as well as very efficient gas turbines, we're about 0.15 tons of CO2 per ton of LNG. A U.S. Gulf Coast project will be anywhere between 20.24 to 0.28 to 0.30, so significantly higher
so
per
double.
Ton of LNG produced.
So almost double.
Yeah, exactly. And so what that means, essentially, simply, is if you build it here at LNG Canada, you're essentially reducing the amount of carbon that would be emitted if you built it in the U.S. Gulf Coast. You know, and so that's something which I think as you're looking at, how do I find my LNG, which helps me with the energy transition, but also how do I find the lowest carbon intensity LNG that really demonstrates that we can have, you know, the most low carbon LNG produced to help us displace higher forms of carbon intensive energy. That's the right project. The other element that I think is important is there's a lot of discussion about, well, why don't you just go all electric? And I know that there's some facilities in the world that are or that will be. It's very important when you're considering to go all electric is where is that power coming from? Because if you're all electric and you're pulling it from a coal-fired power plant, you ain't really doing all that much better. Your carbon intensity is going to be quite high. But if you're all electric and you're pulling from pure renewable sources, then that's good too. But at the moment, that's not happening. And so over time, maybe we'll see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're world-leading. You know, the dream or the objective, I'll call it, in terms of reducing global emissions is, first of all, to push out the coal. That's a no-brainer because the carbon intensity of natural gas is probably half of that of coal when you burn it. But another objective here is to push out lesser efficient LNG producers around the world, ultimately, the ones that, you know, use coal to use electricity to then liquefy the natural gas. And you know, we can slide in there and be one of the cleanest producers of LNG in the world.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing where, you know, people talk a lot about, well, you're increasing emissions here because you're building it here. But the fact is, if you don't actually build it here, you're actually displacing the emissions, increasing them someplace else. And that's called carbon leakage. And so we've had a number of conversations with regulators and legislators who say, oh, well, we can't increase our emissions here. And I said, well, you know, you might feel that, but you know it's just going to get built someplace else, and it won't be as efficient as us. So the net impact, you're actually increasing emissions. And so that's something that's, you know, increasingly recognized. And I think, you know, from the perspective, as you said earlier, Peter, we've done our own essentially wells to wires analysis, which is looking at the full supply chain of where you produce it, transmit it, liquefy it, ship it, and consume it. What is the overall net reduction of greenhouse gases or CO2 as a result of using 1 year supply of LNG? And what we found is it's the equivalent of essentially backing out 40 coal-fired power plants, between 66 to 100 million tons per year, less carbon CO2 than if the coal plants were there, which is more than the total amount of emissions in British Columbia per year, and essentially the equivalent of taking between 14 to 21 million cars off the road. So huge amount of carbon abatement as a result of just 1 year supply from LNG Canada. And if we're serious about global climate change, these are the types of solutions we have to be looking at. And I'll leave one more kind of interesting statistic. If we shut down essentially all of the emissions, we went to zero in British Columbia, that would shut down China for 2 days. So getting to zero doesn't actually help us if someplace else increases the emissions. And so we have a role to play.
Peter did put a commentary out in October 1st. We'll link it to the show notes of this episode. And it talks about if the goal is to reduce our carbon emissions as fast as possible, we don't have time to waste. We should be getting as much low carbon LNG into the world as we can from Canada. But I want to talk about the absolute emissions because there has been some different numbers thrown out there. So I want your opinion. How many megatons will your LNG facility produce, or absolute, annually? Because Pembina put out a number that was about 8.4 million tons per year, which is quite a large number. So I want to understand where that number came from.
Sure. So our facility alone, so each train will emit approximately about 1 million tons per annum of CO2 equivalent. And so for first phase, two trains, approximately 2 million tons per annum.
So a train, just to be clear, a train is like a boatload?
No, a train is essentially what we use to liquefy. So essentially, it's a refrigeration unit, let's call it that, that we use to liquefy the natural gas from sort of ambient temperature down to minus 162.
So these numbers you're quoting,
so that's what we call them.
Over the course of a year, this is what that...
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so essentially per train, 1 million tons per annum. So at our first phase, which is two trains, which will produce approximately 14 million tons per annum of LNG, it will have essentially a carbon footprint of 2 million tons per annum of CO2 equivalent, again, at the most efficient rate of carbon intensity. And then at full build-out, if we go to a full four trains, it'll be approximately 4 million tons per annum of CO2 equivalent. And the Pembina numbers, you know, I'm not 100% sure how they were calculated, but, you know, I think if I'm thinking about what they might have been considering, is they're considering, well, what does the incremental production look like in the upstream associated with that liquefaction? So if you have four trains and you have, you know, a required amount of new production coming on stream in Northeast BC, how much CO2 will that emit? And, you know, that's something which, quite frankly, if you look at the direction of where upstream production has gone, is going, you know, I don't really believe that it'll be that high, especially looking at electrification, especially looking at, and Peter and Jackie, you'll know more than I, potential displacement of natural gas where we don't find it going to the United States. So those numbers, I believe, are quite speculative, and they're certainly not related specifically to what our plant emissions are.
Well, and if you think about the BC government policy, they're talking about going to all hydro for the energy needed for the upstream. And then we're putting some very stringent methane rules mm-hmm. in. So I think that number seems very high because, as you say, the direction of the policy is that the upstream side is going to be quite low emission, probably some of the lowest emission gas in the world. From that perspective.
Oh, yeah, lowest emission and lowest cost. I mean, it's coming out of the ground almost for free. I mean, producers are able to make money, $1.50 Canadian, $2 Canadian. And so it's really quite remarkable.
I'm going to show some WoodMac data that shows where Canada sits in the global supply chain in terms of costs and where the LNG Canada project sits. And this is WoodMac data that shows the prices for various different sources of supply. So I'll post that up with the show notes as well. But you can see that Canada's positioned well versus the United States. There's lower cost sources of supply in Africa and in the Middle East, like Qatar, but people are looking for diversity in their supply. And so we've seen sanctions in U.S. and Canada.
Well, I think it's important to know it's lower cost, not that much lower, actually. But what it is lower emissions here.
When you look at these charts, it does seem like Africa and the Middle East can be $2 to $3 cheaper than Canada. But why are we still seeing people sanction projects in that case?
Well, yeah, and again, a lot of it has to go to why each of your investors, and in our case, each of the five, have decided to invest in Canada. And, you know, part of it is because customers are looking for diversity of supply. Part of it is because, you know, some of our joint venture participants have substantial upstream resources, which they want to monetize. And then on that carbon footprint piece, again, I actually think this is something we should be marketing more. Because looking at, again, how we're really going to be dealing and tackling with climate change, we need to be looking at the overall carbon content of the resources we produce. We do it really well in British Columbia because of those hydroelectric resources available to us. We've got great policies in place, which continue to be, you know, some of the most stringent in the world. You know, I would just add that BC was the first to come out with a greenhouse gas intensity benchmark, which facilities need to meet. So I think we've got leadership here. And I think, again, working with policymakers so that they can help us continue along that progressive pathway of decarbonization while being competitive is something which I think we should all be focused on mm-hmm. because we've really got something that's marketable and pretty powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only stringent, Susanna, but it's also transparent. You know, most of these other countries that have LNG facilities, they're not transparent in disclosing their carbon intensity or their environmental compliance and all those sorts of things. And, you know, we have just some of the most, you know, green, transparent policies here in the world. You're demonstrating that, and it's just not getting out.
Yeah, we need to continue to get that heard. And, you know, and this is where, you know, I always say this whenever I'm given an opportunity to speak, which is for those of us who really believe the importance of our resources and having markets, we need to continue to be heard because certainly, as we all know, there's quite an effective group which has come together to try and stop development in Canada. And we have to be heard recognizing how important it is, not only just because we've made investments here, but when you go to the communities, as I often do, both First Nations and Northern communities in British Columbia and in Alberta, this is also about having food to feed our families. This is actually transformational in many of the communities that I've gone to with First Nations because now they have their own income in working with projects such as these where they can decide how they need to spend money for social programs, for managing prosperity, not poverty. And what I'm actually quite pleased to see is increasingly a number of communities and First Nations are standing up and saying, no, we want to control our own future. We don't believe in the anti-development groups because while they might have protected our trees, who's looking out for our children? And I've heard this numerous times. So we all should stand up and be proud of what we do and start defending it more because we are a resource-rich country. We do it the best. Let's get those resources to market.
Well, thank you for all your work and your passion for this topic. I'm a real champion for LNG. I want to encourage our listeners to follow at LNG Canada on Twitter. I know on your own personal LinkedIn account, you put a lot of great information. And I really encourage people to share these stories, share the stories that are posted there with your followers, because we need to all help support this project and get that information out there. That's everyone's job.
Yeah, thank you, Susanna.
Right. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you, Peter.
And thanks for joining our podcast. And remember to rate us on iTunes and tell someone else about us if you enjoyed the show.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.